From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports show, Only a Game. No one does soliloquies like Hamlet, murder mysteries like Raymond Chandler, or corruption like FIFA. Ahead on Only a Game, the widening scandal surrounding World Soccer's governing body. Also meet former Major League utility infielder Lenny Randle, whose penchant for rap was exceeded only by his ability to cause fair balls to roll foul without touching them. Also, who invented the magical skateboarding move known as the Ollie? Was it Ollie? Also coming up, WNBA star Sue Bird says she's tired of comparisons between women's and men's basketball.
It's a totally different game. And just because you're bigger, faster, stronger, doesn't make you a better basketball player.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Friday, the FIFA poobahs, who hadn't been indicted, expressed their outrage at the discovery of corruption in their midst by re-electing the man who's been running FIFA since 1998. Said poobahs declined the opportunity to replace Sepp Blatter with Prince Ali of Jordan, nor did they wish to put off the election, perhaps fearing that such a move might have meant the number of electors would have been whittled down further by various law enforcement agencies. Joining me now is longtime soccer writer George Vesey, author of 8 World Cups. George, welcome back to Only a Game.
It is always a pleasure, and I mean it.
You and others have written and spoken about malfeasance in FIFA for years, but were you surprised by the arrests and indictments earlier this week and the intention of the Swiss authorities to investigate the process by which Russia and Qatar were chosen to host World Cups?
Well, that investigation has been going on for a few years. Blatter made the Nixonian gaffe of hiring Michael Garcia, a very well-regarded, you know, white shoe lawyer, former prosecutor from New York, who came up with a 450-page document on how FIFA was run, how the election was run, and Blatter would not publish the results. So Garcia quit in disgust. He came back to New York, where he, I am sure, is an associate of, just to drop a couple of names, Loretta Lynch and James Comey, FBI and Attorney General. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm surprised that it has come to this. I'm not surprised that all this stuff goes on.
Is it ironic, do you think, that it's the U.S., which cares relatively little about soccer compared to, say, Spain, Germany, England, and so on, that's leading the charge here?
Well, they got Al Capone on income tax evasion, didn't they? So here's Blatter. I mean, the guy has been passing out packets of dollars, and I mean American dollars, because that's the best money. He's been passing it out to all his delegates from these tiny Caribbean islands. He made sure that more and more countries had their own federations so that they could be voters. And he also had toadies like Michel Platini from France, who caved in favor of Qatar in the last election, and now is going around saying that Blatter has to go. Well, where was he when he had a chance to be honest 4 years ago?
There were some rumblings about the possibility that Sepp Blatter might be unseated. Sunil Gulati, president of the U.S. Soccer Federation, was among the rumblers, but after the first round of voting, Blatter's opponent, Prince Ali, withdrew. Why do you suppose he did that?
Oh, as I understand it, I'm not there, obviously. The prince knew it was over, and he huddled with his advisors, and they said, well, give it up now. Why kill a couple of hours? So I think that was more of a statesmanlike gesture, knowing that the mathematics weren't going to work out for him. Now, where it comes from for Gulati, who I call him a friend, he's an advisor. I'd like to think it was common sense and conscience and finally saying enough is enough when he looks at people like his old colleague Chuck Blazer, ill in a New York hospital, singing like mad about FIFA to get out of actually being indicted.
Suppose that Prince Ali had hung in there and had gotten elected and Blatter was out. Would that have changed anything about the way FIFA has been doing business?
Yeah, I bet it would. This is a smart person. I believe that there would have been business-like practices, and probably a monarchy would have had less autocracy than Blatter.
I wonder if Mr. Blatter's re-election just means that he'll still be president when it's his turn to be led away in handcuffs.
I'd like to think not. I'd like to think the way things are done in the world, you know, the world of business, is it a Visa or a Coca-Cola or a Nike or, you know, however it works, that a few top corporate leaders from around the world would come to pay Herr Blatter a visit in his Zurich office and say, Sepp, it's over, you got to go. I mean, Nixon, you know, he didn't wait for the impeachment to drop and all that. He got on the helicopter. And I would say that Blatter really probably ought to have a helicopter gassed up, and soon.
The awarding of the World Cup to Qatar seemed especially ill-conceived for many reasons, the human rights violations on the top of the list, but an unsuitable climate, the alleged corruption, and no particular soccer history. Any chance the 2022 World Cup transpires someplace else?
I think it's tricky. How can a World Football Federation take away a World Cup from a Muslim nation? I just think, given the grim realities of life today, nasty things could happen because of this. It would not be seen as doing the right thing. It would be seen as prejudice.
George Vesey still writes occasionally for the New York Times, and he blogs at georgevesey.com. George, thank you very much for speaking with me. It's been a pleasure.
Glad to talk to you.
Sometimes the sports stories that aren't getting the most attention are the more interesting stories, and that's why we've created Three Stories You Should Know, a discussion of the matters you might have missed. My guests this week are WBUR reporter Kurt Nickisch, who joins us from Switzerland, where numerous FIFA officials were arrested this week. Also joining me from WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, is Jeremy Markovich. He's a senior writer at Our State magazine and a contributor to SB Nation Longform. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hey. Glad to be here.
Kurt, perhaps you'd like to begin.
One thing you should know is that FIFA is not the only sport federation that has its home in Switzerland. I'm in Lausanne right now, where there are 50 of them. Volleyball, gymnastics, even the World Bridge Federation, if you call that a sport, is here. And one reason they're all here is that, obviously, Switzerland's a neutral, stable country. The International Olympic Committee moved to Lausanne 100 years ago during World War I. Mm-hmm. And so on one hand, that's great because you don't want any single country to have too much power over a sport. But in the wake of these FIFA corruption charges, there are growing calls here right now for oversight of global sports organizations. The Swiss Parliament happens to be working on a whistleblower law, doesn't have one yet. And so even though there are a lot of calls right now to regulate these, which really are not regulated much at all right now, it's not clear what's going to happen.
Jeremy, I wonder if you agree with me. This sounds like the reason that U.S. companies in great numbers are incorporated in Delaware, because they have no rules.
I was having the exact same thought. I mean, who among us doesn't have a Cayman Islands bank account, you know, just to move money offshore so nobody can get at it? It seems like Switzerland getting tougher and maybe requiring more transparency from these different organizations would be good. But then is that treating the symptom as opposed to the disease? And wouldn't these sports organizations look for another place to move their headquarters to?
I think it's a good sign that they're taking it seriously. And one of the headlines in a newspaper here was that, you know, you can't be a pirate and find your home in Switzerland anymore. But if you look at those FIFA charges, it's all in the Americas, which just happened to be where a lot of the financial transactions and a lot of the meetings were held that sort of put this in reach of the U.S. Justice Department. Were they just embarrassed into doing it because the U.S. was taking action? And if their law doesn't have enough teeth, can they actually do anything to these nonprofits? The Swiss would be in a place to act on it, but I don't know. I think it's an open question.
All right. My topic is this. I learned from a story by Christopher Clary in Thursday's New York Times that tennis pros can ask tournament officials not to assign a particular referee to their matches, or at least Rafael Nadal can do that. And he did it at the French Open. This seems very odd to me, and I can't think of another sport in which it would happen. What do you guys think?
You know, I think that giving players a voice to pick the referee is akin to an attorney trying to pick who's on the jury.
Or the judge. I don't want that judge. Give me another judge.
Yeah. I mean, referees are supposed to be impartial. We all have suspicions that the bigger the athlete, maybe a referee does sort of give them calls or something like that. But by allowing a player to say, you know, I don't want to work with this person. I just can't stand them. I don't like them. They're biased against me. And if that actually happens, then who's really running the show here?
Kurt, have you heard anything about this?
I love this story. I mean, my first thought was just, you know, don't tell this to English football fans because they're famous for, you know, death threats and not liking this official and that official. And it does seem like the regulation of judges should come from above and not from below.
I think it maybe still is on the governing body to step in as opposed to a player who step in. I mean, everybody can complain, but when a player complains and says this person needs to be removed and then that person is removed, then again it goes back to the idea that we're not quite sure who's running the show, whether it's the league or the players themselves.
And of course, if it was soccer, the governing body would be FIFA, so there'd be no problem at all, right?
Right.
Jeremy, I understand that you have been paying particular attention to what's been happening after some of the games in which the Golden State Warriors have been involved. What's your story?
Well, my story is not so much about Stephen Curry, who's just been a phenomenal player for the Warriors, but about his 2-year-old daughter, Riley, who during some of the post-game press conferences this week joined her dad and was predictably adorable, crawled around on the stage, yawned very dramatically, at one point heard her dad's voice being amplified over the microphone and said, "Daddy, you're being too loud. Be quiet." That got obviously a great chuckle from everybody in the room. A very small contingent of reporters were a little bit upset, saying that the time that this happened, it took away from questions that they may have asked. But this has kind of been everywhere all of a sudden on the internet. But my thought was, does this not go back to the post-game press conference itself? They've kind of become predictable and formulaic. How do you improve on the post-game press conference without bringing Riley Curry to every single one?
Kurt, I want to direct this to you because you're a reporter and you've been at press conferences where you've been probably sometimes desperate to get something to put into your story. And here comes a 2-year-old kid.
I commend Steph Curry for bringing his daughter to work on not just, you know, bring your daughter to work day. I do think that's not done enough and it's important. But I have to side with the reporters. And just as a radio guy, it's even worse for me because, you know, newspaper people can use his quote saying, you know, we have to grind out that win in game 7. But if I use that quote and his daughter is in the background saying, be quiet and singing, you know, Drake songs, it's nobody's going to take it seriously on the radio.
Well, that's the reason I think 2-year-olds should be at all of these press conferences, because it would encourage all of us to stop taking all this stuff so seriously. And I think that would be a good thing. What do you think?
Well, as long as reporters could say that they didn't want a certain daughter or son and request another one, I think it would be okay.
My guests for the 3 stories you should know have been Kurt Nickisch, who covers business and sports for Only a Game's home station, WBUR. He joined us from Switzerland. And Jeremy Markovich, he's a senior writer at Our State magazine in North Carolina, and he's a contributor to SB Nation Long Form. Guys, thanks very much.
Glad to be here.
Thanks.
The 2015 WNBA season opens on Friday. Sue Bird is set to begin her 13th summer as a point guard for the Seattle Storm, continuing one of the most highly decorated basketball careers in history. This spring, Bird sat down with Only a Game's Doug Tribou.
Sue Bird is 34 years old, grew up in Syosset, New York, and is not related to a certain NBA legend.
Larry Bird scored 60. It is the greatest shooting exhibition I've ever seen in my life. Larry Bird.
When I was a little kid, I mean like 6 years old, I would, you know, I don't want to say lie because I'm 6, but I would tell people he was my uncle, absolutely. And I even wrote like a short story on it in kindergarten. I absolutely did. And how my uncle comes home and teaches me how to play basketball. A short story is very strong. I think I wrote it in crayon. Like I said, I was 5 or 6.
Sue Bird signed her first autograph after a scrimmage when she was 11 years old.
It actually was a St. John's game versus Connecticut. It was an intramural team. My friend's dad was the coach and got us to be the little halftime show. And we went out there and did our thing. And then afterwards, I believe it was a St. John's security guard. And he said, hey, he's like, you put your autograph right here. He's like, you know, you're going to be big someday. I want to be the first one to have your autograph. And I was like, all right, what's that? Like, I didn't even know how to do it, you know? And of course, I went home and practiced. Growing up as a kid, you know, 9, 10 years old, I didn't think like, oh, I want to play professionally. I never said, there was no WNBA, obviously, but I never said, I want to be in the NBA, the first woman. No, that didn't really exist in my world. But, you know, I did see the Olympics. And for me, that was like the pinnacle, the highest. That's where I wanted to be, in somewhere in the back of my mind. My class was one of the first where we were choosing a college knowing there was a WNBA.
Bird chose UConn, and the most pivotal basketball moment of her entire career happened when she was a freshman.
So my first year, I played 8 games. In those 8 games, I was awful. But then I got hurt. I had to sit and live with those 8 games. And, you know, you're a kid, and I remember Street and Smith. I mean, I don't even know if Street and Smith still exists, to be honest. I'm out of touch a little bit with college basketball, but I remember Street and Smith had this, like, preseason kind of rundown of all the teams, and under Connecticut's it was, oh, they have all this talent. Oh, they have this. Oh, they have that. But, you know, do they have a point guard, question mark? And that was my cut out the article, hang it in my locker moment.
Bird for three. Just killer shots.
The dagger.
10 for Sue Bird.
My junior year, we lost in the semifinals of the Final Four. I could tell you pretty much play by play of what happened. To this day, it is a thorn in my side. My senior year, which was the next year, 2002, we went undefeated and won and blah, blah, blah. There was no way we weren't winning a national championship that year because of the year before. That motivated all of us. It propelled all of us. You learn from it. Those failures are going to happen. Yeah, you want to avoid it, but you know at some point it's going to happen, and it's how do you respond to it. So even if I have a bad game, or even in one particular game, if I'm having an off shooting night, being able to keep that confidence up to, even though I'm 0 for 10, but there's 2 seconds and the ball's in my hand and I got to make this, I can go 1 for 11.
Out for Bird. And there is the candidate for Rookie of the Year scoring.
Sue Bird, the first pick in the 2002 WNBA draft, was soon playing for her country and playing professionally in Russia.
It's as a female basketball player, there's a lot you got to juggle. You have your WNBA team you feel very loyal to. You have your overseas team where you do feel loyal, but they're also paying you a lot. And then you have your national team. There was a few years there where if we had 1 week off, A, I was thankful for it, but B, it felt like a lot because you just didn't get that much time. 1 week.
Bird is a 2-time state high school champion, a 2-time NCAA national champion, a 2-time WNBA champ, and a 3-time Olympic gold medalist. But she gets one question a lot.
What's better, college, WNBA, or the Olympics? And I can sit here and honestly say, I don't know. But I can also sit here and honestly say, winning in the WNBA and doing something somewhere for the first time, that's the first time I ever did that. In college, it was expected. Olympics, I mean, we won 5 golds in a row. It's clearly expected. But the WNBA, we had to really fight and grind for that. And in the city of Seattle, the last time they won was sometime in the 70s. It was the Sonics. So in something like 30 years, they hadn't had a professional team win. And to feel a city embrace you, it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
If you don't like the WNBA, that's fine with Sue Bird, but she'd rather not hear about it.
I don't like hockey. Hockey's not a part of my life. I don't watch it. I couldn't tell you 5 players' names if you had a gun to my head, truly. I don't go out there and feel the need to write articles and talk crap about it and say how awful it is and say why I don't like it. And there's something about women's basketball where people feel the need to do that. And I think it has to do with the comparison to the NBA. Oh, they don't do this. They can't do what the men do, when it's a totally different game, you know? And just because you're bigger, faster, stronger doesn't make you a better basketball player. You don't do that in tennis. They don't do that, you know, in golf. They have respect for what Serena Williams does.
She's not ready to retire just yet, but Sue Bird knows how she wants to be remembered.
The only thing that really ever mattered to me was how my teammates viewed me and felt about me. And that doesn't have anything to do with points, rebounds, assists, yada, yada, yada. That's just, you know, being, I don't know, a good person, somebody you can that can be counted on, you know, somebody that when they looked at you, they knew exactly what they were going to get from you because you delivered that and you earned that confidence and that respect. And that, to me, was always the most important. It'll remain the most important. And hopefully I helped people get better.
WNBA star Sue Bird spoke with Only a Game's Doug Tribou this spring at the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference in Boston. Bird and the Seattle Storm open their season next weekend. Mitch Lyons likes a lot of what happens when children play games. He's for competition and he's for fun, but he thinks those games could be more productive and more useful to the children who play them. 4 years ago, Lyons, a retired attorney who has coached at various levels, started the Social-Emotional Learning Alliance of Massachusetts. The organization champions programs where athletes learn about nutrition, the dynamics of social interaction, and their own emotional development, as well as X's and O's. A day after the Social-Emotional Learning Alliance held a conference at the Massachusetts State House, Mitch Lyons and I met at a playground near his home to talk about how sports could be more thoroughly and effectively integrated into the educational process.
The Department of Education's in every single state in the union have given up on sports a long time ago. It was viewed as a place for boys to burn off steam. And there is a elitist attitude of if you do things with your hands, if you use brute force, you're not too bright, which of course is not true. So I will ask kids, okay, run to the end, and I won't say anything. And they'll run at various speeds. And then I'll say, so what does it actually look like when you're running as fast as you can? How does that look? And of course, everybody runs so much faster. They just make the decision that they're going to do that. So when they sit down and do their homework, why not ask the same thing as you do before each and every repetition of a drill? How much effort am I going to give to this? So there's things to learn that they could be reading about. That's sort of like a class. And then the lab, where they test these things, is the team.
What are the particular, you know, if you were king of the forest, what are the particular changes that you would try to institute? Be as specific as you can.
First of all, I changed the electorate that elected me king of the forest. So that, there must be something wrong with them. I'd like to see the Department of Education actually take back athletics, which is going to be viewed as heretical in certain circles. But if it was a Department of Ed running it, they'd run it in an educational model where you read and you study and you have to pass tests. That's right, because we do need to test ourselves so that we see how we're doing.
Are there particular schools or even colleges that you can look at and say, ah, these guys are doing it right? Wouldn't it be great if what these guys are doing was being practiced in lots and lots of other places?
All right, first of all, I don't agree with the thing about right or wrong. People are learning a lot from sports, no question. I know my kids certainly did, so I don't think there's a right or wrong. I'm saying it could be a lot better and much more transferring of this idea that the principal of every school can turn to the athletic director and ask the simple question, how are you supporting the mission of our school?
In other words, it's a different question from the one that's being asked of coaches now, which is, how come you haven't beaten our rival in 6 years and you can't get this team over 500?
Yeah, that's so totally irrelevant. I mean, I don't even know what to say to it, because that's not education. Hey, professional sports, I totally agree. Fire the bum. I don't care. The problem is that we're trying to teach kids, and we can teach them starting at such an early age about the way to treat each other, show compassion, and have empathy. It's the how-to, the process of how to be that good sport with 1 minute left in the game and the ref makes a terrible call. And you're furious. I mean, you literally see red. Well, how do I maintain it then?
As Lyons and I were looking out over the playground filled with kids, he told me he didn't think the vision as presented by the Social-Emotional Learning Alliance of Massachusetts would be realized. I asked him to tell me what he meant by that.
I just mean that this is, you know, a vision for a more perfect society, but we don't live in a perfect society, and there are many forces that are run against what I've said. There's a culture of sports in America. You don't just change that. You change it maybe one school at a time.
Lyons has tried to institute his social-emotional learning plan in a number of different schools. He has not yet been entirely successful. Lenny Randle was a good enough ball player to last 12 years in the major leagues with six teams. The last of those teams was the 1981 and 82 Seattle Mariners. Those teams might have been characterized as bad, but only by an observer inclined toward kindness. No matter, one day during a home game against Kansas City, Lenny Randle gave the few fans on hand something for which to love him.
Fastball tapped at the plate. It'll trickle down the third baseline. The Mariners are going to let it roll, 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 roll. Lenny Randle gets down on his hands and knees and blows on it like a curler, and it goes foul. Randle puts on quite a show, and here comes Jim Frey.
Lenny Randle, welcome to Only a Game.
Ciao, ragazzi.
It sounds like you've been practicing your Italian a good deal since retiring.
9 years in Italy. This is home.
Wonderful. And we're also joined by Nate Patron of Vice Sports, who has been writing recently about athletes who have made music, including the proto-rap single that Lenny made in the early 80s. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Lenny, before we discuss your song, can you remember what you were thinking when you dropped to the ground and blew that ball over the third baseline into foul territory?
I'm totally game-oriented. I had no clue what I was doing. 3-2 count, Willie Wilson at third. I have no play. Larry Anderson's yelling, the pitcher, do something. So I got on the ground and I did something. I yelled. I was going, go foul, go foul, go foul. I did not brush my teeth. I have bad breath. The ball went over the line.
The umpires were laughing, and some of your teammates were too, but they ruled the play interference, and they gave the batter a base hit. Were you surprised at that ruling?
Listen, I need Judge Judy. I want it back. I didn't touch it. His book says don't touch. It wasn't touched. So now supposedly there's a Lenny Randle no-blow rule. Why? I don't know. I see guys talk to their bats. Is that illegal?
Only if they answer.
So I thought it was a normal process.
All right. I don't want our listeners to think that blowing a ball over the foul line is your only claim to fame. Nate, please play DJ and give us a little back announce.
Okay. That was Kingdom by Lenny Randle and Ballplayers featuring Roshana.
Nate, you have become something of an expert on this genre of athletes making music. Would it be inappropriate for me to say it has a beat, you can dance to it, I give it an 8?
I would say, yeah. I mean, this is one of the better ones I've listened to. And this is kind of interesting because, like, this was recorded, what, 81, early 82?
Right.
Yeah, there were national crossover hits by artists like the Sugar Hill Gang and Curtis Blow, but it was still considered like an East Coast scene. So Kingdom, as a early hip-hop party track, actually does stand on its own. Lenny isn't, you know, Kumo D or anything, but as far as old-school party rap goes, it's really fun. Basically, the big difference is that instead of starting a call and response about zodiac signs, he does one about AstroTurf. Now, when you're in the kick, you gotta check out the AstroTurf.
We thought we were the Temptations. It turned into a very fun, happy thing in Seattle. We had to do something to entertain ourselves. We had 12 fans in the stands, so I think 12 happy fans liked that song.
Oh, yeah.
Was the song your idea, Lenny, or did the Mariners front office come to you and say, hey, pal, do something to get us on the map or at least put some fans in the ballpark?
There was a fan that came every day with a kind of a mini entourage named Davey Finnick, and the kid had cerebral palsy, but he couldn't talk. He would write and tap on the desk of his wheelchair, and he'd come during our batting practice. So Julio Cruz and Joe Simpson said, man, we got to do something for this kid. I said, well, let's do a song and write and give him the money for a voice communicator, and then he could talk to us while he's around the cage. So I wrote a song called Just a Chance, Kingdom, because this kid needed a chance at life. So we figured we'd give the proceeds of the song, Kingdom, to him, and we raised about $20,000, got him a voice communicator, gave all the money to the church, Universal Life Church.
Nate, I understand this song is having another life. A Seattle-based archival label has re-released Kingdom on its second volume. How does it stack up against the other tracks?
Kingdom is probably the most interesting track on this second volume because you might look at it and think, oh, that's cute. You have this thing where some baseball players rap, and then it actually turns out to be a jam.
Lenny, what are you up to these days in Italy?
Well, I'm a global general manager. I have a team in Rome, Italy, Nettuno. We're training kids to try to find the next Joe DiMaggio, Roy Campanella, or Mike Piazza. The people I met in the Kingdom are coming over to Italy now. And it's amazing that they want to train and develop these kids. And they also want to boogie a little bit. Some of the guys go, can we have a Zumba festival? So, Nate, that means I might be coming out with a Zumba record.
Nate Patron of Vice Sports has been writing about songs recorded by ballplayers, among other things. Nate, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
And Lenny Randle, late of the Senators, Rangers, Mets, Yankees, Cubs, and Mariners, not to mention everybody's list of super hits. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Take care, guys.
Coming up on Only a Game, fame, fortune, lifelong friendships, and a 35-year wrong set right. Should I even mention this story is set in skateboarding? But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Oh, I'd mention it, Bill, and I'd insist on it, in fact.
That's why I did it. In happier days, FIFA officials probably figured that there was no safer place for them than a 5-star hotel in Zurich. This week, not so.
This is, I do not recall a sports story like this one ever. Between the Swiss police and the FBI, international soccer has been exposed as one gigantic RICO indictment.
Swiss authorities are also investigating the awarding of the 2018 World Cup to Russia and the awarding of the 2022 World Cup to Qatar. The U.S. Justice Department has said the 14 indictments handed down this week constitute only the beginning. And Vladimir Putin has charged the U.S. with having expansionist designs on the World Cup. You can't make this stuff up, right?
This is so great. I'll tell you, though, the people that I think actually should be nervous are the people in the various executive suites at FIFA's corporate partners around the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because Loretta Lynch, the attorney general, indicated that she was going to talk about people who do business with FIFA, too.
Well, some of those corporate partners have been making noises about finding somebody else to partner with, as I understand it.
Well, I'm sure the NFL will take them right in. And over there in the corner, you know, in disguise, is the IOC.
Yes, indeed. Sepp Blatter's defense was, quote, I can't monitor everybody. Julie Foudy, late of the U.S. women's team, tweeted, could you have monitored somebody? Does that seem like it would have been too much to ask?
Actually, Bill, it's not that hard to monitor the crooks in your operation when everybody is a crook.
Charlie, now that Sepp has a fifth term, I don't know how to go on with that question.
They needed an experienced hand to guide them through this crisis.
But is there any chance he sees the light and suddenly FIFA goes straight? I don't know.
How do you possibly reelect this guy?
I don't know. On the bright side, the new edition of FIFA 16, the electronic soccer game, will include women's teams for the first time. I just don't think that's going to be enough to make people forget the indictments.
I don't think Loretta Lynch is going to go easy on them over that, no. We have to emphasize, this is an entire sport that is corrupt.
Right.
At its top levels.
Right, exactly. All right, it's the Golden State Warriors against the Cleveland Cavaliers in the NBA Finals. This seems to be a matchup that excites quite a few people. Tickets on the resale market are currently going for triple the cost of attending last year's Game 1 between the San Antonio Spurs and the Miami Heat. You think this series is going to live up to the hype and the high cost of attendance?
I do. You've got the rising star in the league in Stephen Curry. You've got LeBron James back in Cleveland trying to get himself a title. There's nothing that should hold people back from going to these games. I think it's going to be a heck of a series. I think Golden State will likely win because they are virtually unbeatable in their own place.
We've got 7 days to wait before the finals begin. That's the longest shared layoff in NBA history. June 4th is the day that these finals will actually begin. I hope people remember that the season's still going on.
Well, can you just imagine, though, how many bribes could change hands if this was international soccer?
That's right.
In those 7 days?
It came back to soccer. Somehow I knew that it would. Charlie, how big does the legend of LeBron James grow if his Cavaliers win this championship?
Oh, this would be the final closing argument to the jury on can this guy be reckoned to be the best player who ever lived. Mm. If he comes back to Cleveland and wins them a title with the team he has now, that puts him in the discussion, as Reggie Jackson used to say.
Will the layoff be a factor? I mean, is either of these teams less inclined to be rusty after seven games
off? No, I think at this point in the season, you need to heal up more than you need to worry about being rusty. Mm. The Warriors had a few problems with head injuries in the last series, so I think they're happy to take 7 days off.
Ronda Rousey is the women's bantamweight mixed martial arts champion. Her next opponent, Betch Korea, brought suicide and drugs into this week's Trash Talk. Rousey acknowledged her own drug history and her father's suicide in a recent autobiography. Charlie, I don't follow mixed martial arts very closely, but isn't making Ronda Rousey angry kind of stupid?
You know, I don't follow it that closely either, but I suspect what Ronda Rousey's next opponent has done here has made the mistake Ernie Terrell made against Muhammad Ali, where he wouldn't call him Muhammad Ali, except probably double the revenge factor.
Yeah, exactly. And plus, as I understand it, in mixed martial arts, you can do a lot worse things to somebody.
Oh, yes. That's why they call them mixed martial arts.
Mm, exactly. All right, you're a golfer, so I think you're going to appreciate the recent excellent adventure enjoyed by Tony and Janet Blundy. On Sunday, at a course in Michigan, they each had a hole-in-one on consecutive shots. Tony had the honors. I wonder if after his drive rolled into the hole, he turned to his wife and said, okay, let's see you match that.
I don't know, but I'll tell you what, if they're playing for money, that's a tough way to get a half out of a hole.
I just can't resist the idea that she'd turn back to him and say, there it is, okay.
That wasn't hard.
It was right. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Charlie, thanks very much.
Stay away from the FBI, Bill. They're bound to go for fans sooner or later.
I am sometimes asked why professional athletes get paid millions and millions of dollars to play a game. I generally answer by citing the tiny bit of economics I learned from a graduate student slash instructor in the fall of 1966, when I still believed I should take some courses outside the English department. The athletes generate income for the team owners, I say. The owners make money by investing in the best players they can sign. Sometimes the owners goof and overpay particular players, but this doesn't dissuade them, and in the end they make out very well because they sell their teams for a lot more than they paid for them, in part because the supply of major league teams is limited and the demand is considerable among very wealthy people. But that's not what I'm going to say the next time somebody asks me why pro athletes get paid so much. Instead, I'm going to tell them about Paul Goodrow and his wife, Kelly, who have put off their honeymoon trip to Bermuda because of Tom Brady's 4-game suspension. Don't tell me that makes no sense. I know that. Another thing that makes no sense, at least to me, is that Mr. Goodrow told a reporter he'd had Tom Brady's image tattooed on his body. There is almost no chance that Brady has reciprocated with Paul Goodrow tattoos, and there's no reason to believe Tom Brady himself has put off anything, for example, acquiring a dog. I know this because in Tuesday's paper there's a photo of Tom Brady and the dog, and the picture in which Tom Brady is smiling was posted by his wife, who was no doubt also smiling, obviously less concerned about the suspension than about the dog and the smiling. Also, pro athletes are paid millions and millions of dollars because of Tim Pennoyer, who is worried that the Seattle Seahawks won't be willing to pay their quarterback, Russell Wilson, as much as another team might pay him. Therefore, Tim Pennoyer is encouraging Seattle fans to send their money to augment whatever the Seahawks offer. One name for this is crowdsourcing, and Mr. Pennoyer has said that if it turns out the money isn't necessary, it will go to charity. That is a fine thing, except for the part about Russell Wilson. In the photograph accompanying the newspaper story about this goofy strategy, Russell Wilson is smiling even more broadly than Tom Brady is in the photo with his new puppy. Which is why, when I'm next asked why pro athletes are paid millions and millions of dollars, I won't have to rely on the economics I must have learned in 1966 because I passed the final. Although, come to think of it, I suppose it is still a matter of supplying people with the razz and also the mataz that they demand. For a time, the Ollie was the holy grail of skateboarding moves. Before it was invented, it was the one thing all skateboarders wanted to do but couldn't, and when it was finally mastered, it changed the sport. But was the Ollie really invented by a guy named Ollie? Only a Game's Karen Given investigates.
When I was growing up in the 80s, I thought my older brother was really cool, and he owned a skateboard. John only really knew one trick. He'd be tooling around, nothing special, and then he'd crouch down, shift his feet on the board, and pop, lift off. John and his skateboard would catch air, just a few inches, but I never understood how his skateboard stayed attached to the bottom of his feet while he sailed over the asphalt. It looked to me like my brother, a mere mortal, a band geek, had just broken the laws of physics. It was magic.
It is, yeah. It's very magic, and there's a whole science and physics to it that I can't really explain.
That's Craig Snyder, and he's written an entire book, a 912-page book, on that one trick, the Ollie. Before the Ollie, the one thing all skateboarders were searching for, yearning for, was air.
The 1970s were about, you know, breaking free from gravity. I think that really began, in the 1960s with Evel Knievel. He was a huge influence. Can I do that? Can I get air?
Skateboarders just couldn't do it. They could ride up and down the walls of abandoned pools all they wanted, but most were stopped in their tracks by a 6-inch curb. Today, skateboarders just do an ollie. If you see a street skater hop from the ground to a rail or a ledge, that's an ollie. Lots of the high-flying tricks in the X Games start with an ollie as well. There's even a Finnish pop song dedicated to the frontside ollie. It spent a couple of weeks at number one back in 2012. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Back in the mid-70s, Craig Snyder and his friends were regulars at Florida's Skateboard USA, one of more than 100 new skate parks across the country. One of the youngest skaters in the group was Alan Gelfand. His friends called him Ollie.
Alan did an ollie like no other person. No one to this day has done ollies like him. And if you saw him do it back then, I mean, it was so effortless, and he was definitely an original and an originator.
But was Ollie really the originator of the move we now call the Ollie? As Snyder dug deeper for his book, he realized the story he'd always known, the story he thought he'd witnessed, was wrong. So he sat down for a rewrite, and while he was at it, he checked in with his old friend, Alan Gelfand.
When I emailed Alan and just gave him like a brief synopsis of the way the book had now taken shape, his reply to me was, "I know you know."
This is what we know for sure. During the summer of 1977, 14-year-old Alan Gelfand was working on the lip slide. It was a trick his friends had already mastered. But something totally unexpected happened. All four wheels came off the wall. His friends called it the Ollie Pop. Fast forward a year and a half, and Alan debuted an even more impressive move, the Ollie Air, in front of photographers in Southern California. This was the real game changer. The physics of this trick opened up skateboarding to all sorts of new innovations. Not long after, Alan and his new move were featured in Skateboarder magazine.
People opened up that issue, and they were just blown away. They weren't sure what they were seeing. You know, is this some sort of trick photography? Did he land it? Did he fall off? You know, it just didn't seem believable.
A year later, he performed his signature trick for Hal Jepsen's movie, Skateboard Madness.
Florida's Alan Gelfand, originator of the Ollie Air.
Alan signed endorsement contracts. He traveled the world and wowed crowds. No one's denying that Alan Gelfand invented the Ollie Pop. But thanks to Craig Snyder's new book, we now know that Alan didn't invent the Ollie Air. It was shown to him by someone else. 17-year-old Jeff Duer was part of Alan's group of friends at Skateboard USA. Jeff had developed a trick of his own. His friends called it the Duer. Today, we call it the Ollie. Here's what Snyder says really happened. One day, after Skateboard USA had permanently closed, Jeff hopped the fence and noticed Alan doing the same thing. Jeff showed Alan his new trick, and soon, Alan was better at it than Jeff had ever been. Alan Gelfand loved attention. He loved the media. But every time Alan went running toward the camera, Jeff headed the other way.
He didn't like the media. He had a distrust of the media. When the cameras would come out, you know, he would stop skating. He skated for the love of it. You know, it was an art form.
Jeff kept performing the trick that was making his friend famous for a while, until one day he was down in Miami and a group of skaters asked if Alan had shown him how to do the ollie.
Jeff was incensed, you know, and it was like, no, I showed it to Alan. And that really hurt him. He's always been like a little bit reclusive, and so that just made him recede a little more, you know, into the background.
Jeff didn't fight back. He didn't demand that Alan set the record straight. He simply stopped performing his trick in public. And for 35 years, even many of his friends didn't know the truth.
I think I was the only person he would tell the story to. And he only told me the story. We never did a phone interview. It was always email because he wanted everything written so that I would not misquote him. I would not take things out of context. He was very careful, even with me.
Snyder isn't taking Jeff Duer's word on all of this. He hunted down other skaters who were there. As for his old friend Alan Gelfand, well, he didn't exactly deny it.
His reply to me was, "I know you know." He was aware that I was aware of Jeff Duer and the Duer.
"I know you know." How'd you take that?
I was like, "Oh, good.
Perfect.
Let's get this over with."
Craig Snyder still sees his book as a celebration of his friend Alan, but he wants to make sure Jeff gets credit too. Neither Alan Gelfand nor Jeff Duer agreed to talk to me. Alan stopped competing professionally at 16. He already had two bad knees. He raced cars for a while and opened a private skate park called Ollie Land. Jeff followed a different dream. Today, he's devoted to wildlife conservation. But before that, the man who created the move that made me, as a kid, believe that the laws of physics had been broken, completed all the coursework for a PhD in physics. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Craig Snyder's book is called A Secret History of the Ollie, Volume 1, the 1970s. For our video of what the world would be like without the ollie, visit onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout, and we had help this week from Marquise Neal. Our intern is Joe Jacobs, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Finnish pop sensation Robin. No, no. I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thank you for listening.